And it said that this was the second discourse the Buddha gave after his awakening. And I read some a few years ago. I was in the bookstore and I saw the fire discourse by the Buddha in an anthology of the most famous speeches given by humankind, or the greatest speeches of human history or something. And there was the Buddha in his fire sermon. And maybe you've probably heard it before, but this is a part of it. He says, and you have to imagine some great orator reciting this, not just me here. The eyes are burning, the ears are burning, the nose is burning, the tongue is burning, the body is burning, the mind is burning, thoughts are burning, all are burning with the fire of greed, the fire of anger, and the fire of ignorance. The whole world's on fire, and we use the metaphor of fire a lot. I mean, we're on fire with anger, it's fever of anger, we might say, the fire of passion. There's all these fires that we might have, and some of these fires are quite agitating, and sometimes we're addicted to them, like the Doors, who sang, "Come on, light my fire." But the idea of fire being something which represents the agitated state of being when we're filled with jealousy or rage or filled with greed or lust, filled with desire, anxiety, regret. Because all these things can kind of be feverish within us, kind of fire. Remember when I was first went to Thailand to practice, I was very enthusiastic, to say the least, about practicing about Buddhism. And I was talking to a monk, and he said to me that my eyes were on fire. And I didn't understand what he meant. I didn't know his context for his reference, but years later I realized that he was picking up on my excessive fervor. So the restless and agitated mind is all too common. And I think that there's, in modern corporate, modern technological culture, the agitated mind is taking is getting a new lease on life, or takes a whole new form, in that there are people who are so driven within their work context, driven to use their mind and constantly kind of a compulsive nature of their mind, which is kind of goes nonstop. They get up and they start work, and they don't really leave work at work, but they bring it home, or they don't even, the home is work, or work is home, or whatever. And there's a constancy, constant involvement with an activity. I've seen some people, they work 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, hardly with a break at all, using their mind in a particular way. That actually lends a kind of fever to the mind, kind of feeds the potential in our mind to be compulsive or driven. And so it tends to add to the agitation of mind, the agitation of body. So much so, if those people come to a full stop and just sit down to meditate for a day or for an hour or for 5 minutes, one of the first experiences is that the momentum of all that agitation, all that drivenness, all that restlessness kind of is built up in the body, all the tightness and contraction which needs to unwind. So I believe, maybe I'm wrong, but there's a whole other dimension to agitation and restlessness that comes from the way many people work in our society. But I think it's very common. One of the qualities of agitation, restlessness, is that it often is self-propelling or self-generating. We get ourselves involved in an agitated mode, in a restless mode, there's a way in which it fuels itself. It kind of wants more, kind of just always desiring more, or wants to be more preoccupied. And maybe it works a little bit this way, that to be in an agitated, driven, or compulsive mode of being, it tends to alienate ourselves from ourselves. We tend to not to feel ourselves. It's an uncomfortable state to begin with. And it's a state of often alienation from ourselves. And both those things, the discomfort of the state itself and the state of not being in touch with oneself, is an unpleasant state to be in. And so that unpleasantness generates a desire to fix it, to have some solution, to fill that unpleasant vacuum. And so we look outside of ourselves because that's what the habit is, the compulsion is to keep looking. And so we're driven to kind of look outside ourselves for something more. We get involved with too many things at once and the mind gets fragmented. And that, and so we don't just settle on one thing, but that very unsettled feeling keeps us driven to keep looking for more things to fill ourselves with, and we get more and more fragmented. And so physically, we can be always on the move. I mean, we probably all know people who can't sit still at all. Their hands are constantly, fingers are constantly tapping or moving, or their hands or their feet are constantly kicking around, or they're constantly squirming and never really sitting still, because their mind is basically, their hearts are agitated and it gets expressed in the way their body's moving. And it's possible, I know I've had the experience of not really knowing what my body does when I'm agitated. I just kind of, my body does the stuff and I'm just so preoccupied or so cut up or so driven that I hardly notice that my body's in this way. And it's very fascinating, of course, to stop the fidgeting of the body and just sit still physically and see what happens to those energies of fidgeting if you sit still and give them a chance to course through the bottom, through the body, without giving expression to them. If we give expression to them, it's often like it becomes self-perpetuating. If we stop moving, rather than repressing it, sometimes it gives it a chance to kind of unwind that it can't have if we just keep, you know, fidgeting our fingers or whatever we do. And then there's, of course, mental agitation and restlessness. And this is quite common for meditators to experience because we discover how busy our mind can be and how our mind chases after thoughts and concerns. And we try to sit down here and be somewhat still and quiet and present for our breathing or present in the moment. And the mind has completely other plans. You know, you've been planning for weeks to come here, you know, and your mind's not cooperating. The mind is restless. It's looking for other things. And it's quite, it can be quite tiring to actually sit down and watch. It's tiring anyway, but to actually sit down and notice the consequences of the mind constantly chasing after thoughts and preoccupations. And it really is a drain on us. And in the movement of the body and the agitation of the body, agitation of the mind, in that we're driven, the kind of a drivenness, a kind of compulsive nature to it, we often don't even notice the cost it has on us. We often don't even notice that we're agitated. We don't notice that we're restless. Because restlessness kind of carries us out of ourselves. And in that out of ourselves, we don't notice actually how we are. One of the fascinating things that can happen as people begin meditating and sitting on retreats, for example, is to discover that what they took, how their mind operates in the normal life, that they took for granted. Oh, this is the way all minds are, aren't they? Thank you. You know, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way God made human. You know, God made us to be constantly chattering and busy and chasing after our thoughts. And suddenly you come to meditate and maybe for some reason you settle below that level of surface mind that's constantly chattering and you realize for the first time, wait a minute, this is not inherent to being a human being to have this constant anxious chattering of my mind. It's possible to have the mind much more at ease and resting and at peace. So part of the, when our restlessness and our agitation is all too common part of our lives, we can't take it for granted. We take it. This is. We take it. This is normal, whereas it's actually completely unnormal. It used to be that working 9 hours a day was unnormal. Now now it's normal, and working 10 hours is not normal. Or maybe it's worse than that, isn't it? Some people work longer hours, and you know, if you work 10 hours a day at work, then you're normal. You know, and you don't think about it because everyone else is working 13. And you feel kind of bad and guilty you're not working enough hours. So there's a way in which it's all too easy for human beings to be, in some sense, blindly accepting of the status quo, even when the status quo is harmful for us. And the same thing with our inner life, the agitated mind. So as I said, the agitating mind can be self-generating, self-perpetuating. Desire breeds more desire. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is, as I said earlier, it's to be caught up in desire, which is about objects outside of us, something we want. We don't settle on ourselves, and so we alienate ourselves from ourselves. And so that the discomfort lends itself to wanting more. And this is not a good example, but it's kind of maybe coming to mind right now. Some 20 years ago, I had a wheat allergy. And one of the characteristics of allergies, sometimes food allergies, is you crave what you're allergic to. And before I knew I had the allergy, when I felt a little bit crummy, I would eat, and I worked at the bakery, so I had lots of bread around me. And I would get these wonderful baguettes, and I would kind of comfort myself with a baguette because I felt kind of down, so I'd eat some baguettes. And I'd feel worse because I was allergic. But I didn't know I was allergic, I just knew I felt worse. So I would want to comfort myself even more, so I'd eat more baguettes. And so there were times where I just eat myself completely silly. I remember walking through San Francisco in the streets there, thinking that I should be institutionalized because I couldn't think, and I was, thank God no one was talking to me, and I just felt completely numbed out on this, you know, wheat poisoning, gluten poisoning. And I didn't, you know, I was just, here I was, you know, stuffing myself anyway, you know. So desire. Sometimes the excitement of desire, the excitement of wanting, is so much better than having. As Calvin says to Hobbes, getting is better than having. When you get something, it's new and exciting. When you have something, you take it for granted and it's boring. But everything you get turns into something you have. That's why you always need to get new things. And Hobbes says, I feel like I'm in a stockholder's dream. Calvin, waste and want, that's my motto. So getting is better than having. So let's get more. Getting is more important than just being. So our restlessness can be very subtle, of course. I mean, it's quite easy to point to the pervasive restlessness of many people in our culture, or our pervasive restlessness when it's really strong. But someone who meditates and begins experiencing a little bit more calm in their life will start discovering that restlessness is actually can be very, very subtle. And even the kind of conventionally calm states of being, we say, I'm really calm right now. The mind can still be restless, even in a calm state of mind, even a calm state of being. If the mind is kind of, even very subtly, in very small movements, compulsively going after pleasure or going after avoiding, kind of pulling away from things that are unpleasant, wanting that thought, not wanting that to choose, it might not be in a kind of fast way, but the mind is still kind of restless, it's still kind of not settled completely. Even though 90% of us is settled, the mind can still be somewhat restless. It's interesting that in the traditional descriptions of how a person becomes liberated or awakened or enlightened person, there are four stages. And it's not until the fourth stage, the final stage, when a person becomes fully awakened, that restlessness has completely been uprooted. So you can be somewhat enlightened, let alone unenlightened, and restlessness is going to be part of your potential, part of your psyche. Always, even when the mind gets very, very quiet and tranquil, there's going to be some level of restlessness still operating. So it can get very, very subtle. So that's why it's a very interesting topic for meditators. It's not just simply a matter of looking at restlessness when we are kind of conventionally restless, but even as the mind gets very, very still and quiet, it's useful to look and notice the restlessness of the mind, the restlessness of our thoughts, our thinking, of our body. In fact, restlessness is understood to be one of the universal companions of our suffering. That if there is suffering, then there's some element of restlessness there as part of it. And some might even say that the restlessness is the cause for a lot of our suffering. I don't know if I'd go that far, but Restlessness is really, really, for some people, really the key element that keeps them driven in a way that keeps them suffering, keeps them contracted. So the mind is agitated when it's reaching for things, or avoiding things, or recoiling from things. When it's the mind is agitated and restless, when it all too easily jumps on board and holds on to a particular kind of concern that you're ruminating over or thinking about. And it's hard to get off that thought train. There's kind of restlessness there. If you weren't restless, there wouldn't be the clinging. And if it wouldn't be the clinging, it'd be easy to step off and let go of that and just let it self-liberate itself into nothing. We're looking outside of ourselves. We're looking inside of ourselves for some answer. To be always looking for something, inward, outward, as an answer, it means the mind is restless. If we're looking into the future, tomorrow, or the end of the day, I'll finally be happier. The end of the day, I'll finally have that great experience of calm that I was always wanting. To always be looking ahead or looking for someplace else for the answer, the mind is restless in that moment. It's kind of actively pursuing something beyond itself and outside of itself. So what are some of the causes of restlessness in you? Do you recognize agitation, restlessness when it occurs? And what are some of the causes within you for it? What are some of the ways in which you can relate to it? One of the classic causes of restlessness and anxiety, agitation, is regret or fear of blame, shame. If you've done something that you regret, or you've done something that you're afraid someone's going to catch you for having done, you're afraid of being blamed, then the mind is often agitated. This kind of restlessness of the mind that occurs. And in the time of the Buddha, in the Buddha's instructions, he said the preeminent antidote to restlessness was to live a blameless life, to live a life which no one could blame you for having done something wrong. You don't go around stealing or taking what's not yours or lying or doing anything that can kind of a wise person kind of blame you for. Say, that wasn't a good thing to do. So to have regret for your past actions and not having come clean with it, not having maybe confessed it or come clean with what you've done, is a cause of restlessness. And in a sense, that's a kind of healthy restlessness. If you've done something that you regret and you've really harmed someone else, it's actually beneficial. It's actually a normal thing. It's healthy to have some kind of agitation or some sense of ill, kind of being a little bit off when you've actually done something to harm someone. So the Buddha stressed the importance of living a clean life. And if your life is not and hasn't been clean, then come clean from that day on or the best you can. We all make mistakes, so it's very useful to come clean, to confess. I remember some years ago, I was working on a friend's computer, and I think I did something odd. But anyway, the computer crashed. And I remember I was kind of pretty concerned, what is he going to think when he comes home, you know? And so I just came clean right away. I said, look, your computer crashed. You know, I was on it, and this is what I did. And he said, oh, okay, well, after dinner, I'll look at it. And I was like, oh. Or when I was a teenager, I was 14, and my friend and I crashed my father's car into a bulldozer. And so, uh-oh. We didn't have a driver's license even. We just, found the keys and off we went into the bulldozer. And so I called him up and had to say, just explain to him what had happened. And he said, does it still drive? And I said, yes. And any problems? Well, it can't open the right-hand door. He said, well, see what you can do about it, and I'll be home tonight. That's the extent of it, I think he knew that I felt really bad, and but he didn't feel any need to get angry with me or do anything, just like the situation itself was enough. So I came clean. I said, I called him. I said, what happened? And, does it still drive? Yeah. See what you can do about the door. And I was never reprimanded for driving his car without a driver's license. We didn't get very far, of course, because we didn't know how to drive. We just basically turned the key on, the engine on, and plowed into the bulldozer, which was parked right parked right next to us. So living a life which is blameless, living a life where we come clean, is really helpful to develop an unagitated state of being. Now in the West, of course, many of us are agitated about ourselves, not for anything we've done, but because of some assumption we have that something is inherently wrong about us. And you know, we've lived an exemplary life. We've done, you know, we've never done anything to harm anyone our whole life. We've been saints, and just impeccable in everything we do, and we're just completely convinced that we're just like the most rotten person on the planet, and you're completely unworthy of anyone's love. So it's a kind of Western sign of anxiety about self, which seems to have nothing to do with our actions. And the Buddha didn't really address this. It wasn't, maybe back to 2,500 years ago, that wasn't such a common phenomena. But you know, that's the whole area for psychotherapy, for example, is that kind of anxiety about who we are existentially, which has no basis in fact. It's just an assumption that we've taken on or some imbued inside of us. Unfounded ideas we have about ourselves, which are really deeply rooted in our emotional psyche. And so it's very important then to try to heal our woundedness. And that's part of what both practice and therapy is supposed to help us do, is to help us heal us from some of this woundedness that leaves us feeling that we're somehow wrong or bad for unfounded reasons. So that also can make us restless. Another thing that makes people restless is their concept of self, building and sustaining and defending a sense of self, a self-concept, a self-identity. And one of the reasons why we get restless in doing that is that any concept we have about who we are is inherently unstable. It's inherently incomplete. None of us fits beautifully into that category, that mold of this is who I am. And so if we're holding on to some concept and idea of who you are, whatever it might be, it's always going to be a limited version of who you are. And it's also going to be an unstable version, because concepts, you know, reality flows and changes much faster than concepts do, and certainly who we are. So if we hold on and depend on a certain concept of self, we're depending on something which is unstable and incomplete, and so it's not really ever going to do it for us. It's not going to provide us with the kind of security, provide us with the kind of well-being that we're trying to get by holding on to this concept of self or building it or defending it. And so we're always going to be left a little bit agitated and a little bit restless. Well, let's do a better job. Let me defend myself a little bit better. Let's do something else. Let me read. At one time, the Buddha was staying in the town of Kosambi. And in this town there was one who resented him and who bribed wicked men to circulate false stories about him. Under these circumstances, it was difficult for his disciples to get sufficient food from their begging, and there was much abuse. Ananda said to Buddha, "We had better not stay in a town like this. There are other and better towns to go to. We had better leave this town." The Buddha replied, "Suppose the next town is like this, what shall we do then?" "Then we move to another." The Buddha said, "No, Ananda, there will be no end in that way. We had better remain here and bear the abuse patiently until it ceases, and then move to another place. There are profit and loss, slander and honor, praise and blame, pain and pleasure in this world. The enlightened one is not controlled by these external things. They will cease as quickly as they come. This is the eight worldly dharmas, which keep people agitated. If we're concerned and chasing after these things, and these things are really important for our well-being, we'll remain agitated because they're unstable. Profit and loss, slander and honor, praise and blame, pain and pleasure. So somehow the Buddha wasn't going to be influenced by these things. He wanted to keep his inner stability, perhaps. Another time the Buddha said, if outsiders speak against me, or against my teaching, or against the order of monastics, you should not be angry, for that would prevent your own self-conquest. Similarly, if they praise us. But you should find out what is false or true and acknowledge the fact. And even in praise, it is only a trifling matter. It is only of trifling matters that an uninitiated person will praise the Buddha. So he's not really interested in praise. People don't really understand. If the Buddha, who's so well-developed spiritually, someone who's not developed themselves has no understanding of the freedom of mind and the heart of the Buddha. So he doesn't care about the praise that people give. Not to be concerned, not to be moved and swayed by praise and blame, not to be swayed by some people's criticism of us, but rather just to simply take it, oh, what's the truth here? What's the falsehood in here? And then move on from there. And I think for many people, that's a very difficult place, is when we get criticized. We tend to get very agitated. One of the exercises I would recommend you, it's difficult to arrange for this. I was lucky enough to fall into it one day. And that is, when you find yourself as someone who's really angry with you, and really furious, just sit there and receive it without saying anything. And I did that once, and I was curious to see how long the person could attack me without me saying anything. And it lasted an hour. I was just kind of like, wow. My mind was going, wow, this is amazing. I was just like in awe. Wow, you know. And it was a great thing, you know. Great exercise in mindfulness and how not to take things personally and not to be agitated. Just kind of just like the wind going through, you know. Just kind of like, wow, amazing. And the next day the person came to me and said, you know, that was so helpful, so useful, because always before when I get angry at people, they always run away. And you're the first person who stayed there with me. It actually helped me come to better terms with my anger. Anyway, to have the chance, you know, don't orchestrate the occasion. But look for the opportunity maybe to just to be a recipient of anger and just be amazed rather than defensive. There's this interesting passage from this. Then the Venerable Anuruddha went to where the Venerable Sariputra was staying, and on arrival greeted him courteously. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat down to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Sariputra, by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human eye, I see the thousand-fold cosmos. My persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into singleness. And yet my mind is not released from my compulsions. My mind is not freed from my clinging. Then Sariputra answered, my friend, when the thought occurs to you, by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos. That thought is related to your conceit. When the thought occurs to you, my persistence is aroused and unsluggish, my mindfulness is established and unshaken, My body is calm and unperturbed. My mind is concentrated into singleness. That is related to your restlessness. When the thought occurs to you, and yet my mind is not released from compulsion and not released from clinging, that is related to your anxiety. It would be well if, abandoning these three qualities, not attending to these three qualities, you directed your mind to the deathless. So after that, Venerable Anuruddha, abandoning conceit, restlessness, and anxiety, not attending to these three qualities, directed his mind to the deathless. Dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute, he in no long time reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life for which clansmen rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself in the here and now. He knew, birth is ended, the holy life is fulfilled, the task is done. There's nothing further for the sake of this world. And the Venerable Anuruddha became another one of the arhats, the fully awakened ones. So in terms of restlessness, I thought it was very interesting that Sariputra says that your thoughts about my mindfulness is well established, my persistence is aroused and unsluggish, to associate these qualities to a self, to me, myself, I'm the one who's doing this, I'm the agent, I have these qualities. That's still, the mind is still operating on a level of restlessness to make that assumption. And that sounds very strange to some people, because isn't that a completely reasonable thought to have, you know, that I'm sitting here with lots of energy and persistence? I think when the mind is really settled and really at peace in itself, to even formulate the idea, this is my mind which is concentrated, the mind has to be a little bit restless and agitated for that to happen. And now, that's a bit challenging to many people. The idea that I'm not supposed to have any thoughts about myself. Who am I then if I'm not thinking about myself? Have you ever thought about that? Another cause of restlessness is wanting certainty and security. It's almost that our desires for security leave us insecure, leave us restless. The mind is not settled on itself. It doesn't know how to be at peace with itself. Maybe the mind is too easily swayed by the eight worldly dharmas. And so it looks outside of itself for something which can provide security, something which is going to provide for our well-being. And this is a classic spiritual teaching, of course. You know, we look outside of ourselves for happiness, for security. And since everything outside of ourselves has some level of instability, we're putting our eggs in an unstable basket. Or the famous quote in the Vipassana world, some woman said, I forget how the quote goes, so I'll drop it. but in that we look outside of ourselves, the instability of what's outside of us is counterproductive, works against us, and actually keeps the mind a little bit agitated, or quite agitated. There's this beautiful letter that Ajahn Chah wrote to Ajahn Sumedho. Maybe you guys know about it. The story goes that Ajahn Chah never really wrote letters to anyone. He was just a forest monk who lived in Thailand. And Ajahn Sumedho was his American student, who many of you know. And Ajahn Sumedho was living in England then, the abbot of a monastery there, and Ajahn Chah, this was shortly before he had a stroke and became kind of mentally incapacitated. He wrote this to Ajahn Chah, to Ajahn Sumedho. Whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building the paramitas, building good spiritual qualities within you. That's a wonderful statement to make. Whenever you have love and hate, when a traditional Buddhist monk talks about love, he basically means kind of neurotic love of clinging and attachment. He says those are actually your aids, almost like your friends. Those are the material you're going to compost. That's what you're going to work with. So rather than being at odds with these things when they appear, you're in a kind of way are welcoming your very difficulties, because this is where you're going to develop your spiritual qualities. The Buddha Dharma, the Buddha teaching, the Buddha practice, is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This sumedho is your place of non-abiding. So this is a little bit interesting, not moving forward, not moving backward, and not standing still. Many of us talk about finding a center inside of ourselves we can rely on. At least, you know, I have this balanced center inside of me. I have to find my center. I've lost my center. And he's saying here, basically, forget about your center. You don't even stand still. You don't even stand on your own center. But you also don't move forward. You don't move back. You're not agitated. You find the place of non-abiding. You don't abide anywhere. And that's the greatest stability. That's the great place of greatest peace, is when you don't have to settle any place at all, rest any place at all. The mind doesn't move forward into something to get something. The mind doesn't avoid and move backward, and it doesn't rest where it's at, but rather just it's kind of like maybe a boat in the middle of the ocean. You know, a sailboat in the middle of a great storm with big waves and stuff. The essential thing to do is to take down the sails, because if you keep sailing, you have too much velocity. And you'll fly off the big waves and slam into the next one, or slam down to the troughs of the waves, and the boat will break apart. But if you take down the sails and have no momentum, no speed, then you'll just bob up and down in the waves. And I've been in huge storms where, you know, it's completely safe because you're just kind of bobbing up and down, and you're not abiding anywhere. You're not hanging. You're not going forward. You're not going backwards. You're not anchored anywhere. But you're just kind of riding the waves peacefully. Howling wind around you. The place of non-abiding. One of the most pervasive causes of restlessness, that's often sometimes the most subtle and most useful area to explore, is the movement towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. It's almost the amoeba-like movements of the mind or of our being towards pleasantness and away from unpleasantness keeps us agitated, keeps us restless. We want the pleasant, we want to avoid the unpleasant. And a really important part of Dharma practice, of sitting practice and meditation practice, is learn how to be at peace with things regardless of whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. Not to hold on to pleasantness, not to be chasing and running away from unpleasantness, but simply whatever occurs, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, to stay present, balanced, at peace, unagitated, unmoved by that. So how do we cultivate restfulness, or the unmoving mind, or the non-abiding mind? One of the ways is by appreciating stillness, by appreciating the value of being unmoving, not chasing after things, not being agitated in the body, not moving a lot when we're sitting. Now, there's a wonderful meditation called the mountain meditation, where you visualize yourself stable like a mountain, unmoving like a mountain. And no matter what happens on the mountain, storms, thunder, lightning, whatever, the mountain is unmoved by it. Just stand there, kind of poised and balanced. So you imagine yourself, especially if you sit cross-legged, it works well because you're kind of a triangle. Imagine yourself balanced and poised like a mountain. But it helps to develop stability and stillness of mind and heart and body if we appreciate the value of it. And one of the values of it, which I talked about this morning, is that as soon as you kind of start holding yourself somewhat still in a gentle, unrigid way, physically, mentally, what you very quickly encounter is the ways in which you're not still. And a very important place of practice is in the interface between stillness and movement. What happens there in that place between the two of them? What happens to your desire to move? What happens to your restlessness when you can't move because you meet your commitment to stillness? We learn about ourselves a lot, and we can kind of get deeper into the roots of ourselves much more easily at that interface between the two. Doesn't mean you have to hold yourself tight and rigid, but appreciate the value of the stillness, which is always there. And related to this is to meet your restlessness with stillness, or meet your restlessness with acceptance, meet your restlessness with mindfulness, to take an interest in your restlessness, not to give into it by fidgeting more or being agitated more or kind of chasing after those compulsions, but turning the mind, mindfulness, into the restlessness itself and how it feels in the body, how it feels in the mind. Is like, you know, that's one of the key things we do in mindfulness, is we turn into things and feel them as they are, rather than letting them continue to drive us and run us in all kinds of ways. So when we feel physical agitation, to let the body be the container for that agitation, to let, rather than moving and giving expression to the agitation, make your body this big container within which the agitation is like this huge ping pong ball, which is kind of just bouncing around, or, you know, just add, you know, 10,000 bumblebees, which are kind of going crazy inside of you. Just kind of let the agitation just move within you, and just let it kind of bounce around in there. It'll quiet down pretty quickly if you hold it in the bigger container. And the same thing with mental agitation. Let it occur in a mind held spaciously. You know, it's interesting, if you find yourself really agitated someday, go someplace where it's really peaceful, really still, like some big open room, like come here where no one's here or something. And let your agitation be felt inside all the space of this room. And you'll find probably agitation will settle pretty quickly. If you make a bigger container of stillness for your agitation, that can often help. So the awareness itself, the awareness held still, gentle, compassionate, open awareness held still, be committed to staying present to the agitation, to hold the agitation, to cradle it, is one way of letting mental agitation kind of settle itself, or at least seeing it clearly and seeing what causes it. So we can investigate it. What's the cause of it? Am I defending a sense of self? Am I agitated because I'm trying to create a sense of self here? Am I agitated because I'm trying to have pleasure? Am I agitated because I want security? What is the cause of it? You know, again, this thing, idea of having a finding center inside of yourself, it might be a useful sense to have and a useful idea to have. But you might experiment, rather than having a still center, having a still container. Can you be a still container for what's going on? Because then everything's happening within you. If you have a still center, then maybe there's kind of a duality between you and what's outside of you, the agitation which you don't like. One of the interesting places to see the sense, the interface between stillness and movement, because the two things can happen together. And what we're developing in practice, as a practice of mindfulness develops stronger, is a sense of these things. They're not really separate exactly, or they're. I don't know. It's very difficult to describe how this stuff works, but it's as if. All the movement of life, all the impermanence of life, none of it that we resist, none of it, we stop none of it, we judge none of it, but it all happens within the larger field of stillness, of calmness, of peace. One of the examples I like to describe this, I don't know if it works for everyone, but it works for me, I've been in a situation driving where I've been in a very near accident. And it was obvious that it was I just missed, you know, some major accident that maybe would have taken my life by just hairs. And, you know, nothing happened, but, you know. And as soon as, a moment or two after I realized that everything's okay, and, the concerns I had just before the accident, the preoccupations that seemed so important, no longer seemed so important anymore. You know, I had a brush with death. And suddenly there's this tremendous stillness all around me. Like suddenly there's all this stillness and peacefulness that seems to be all pervasive. And I'm still driving, I'm still thinking a little bit and still kind of aware of the movement around me and everywhere. But it's all happening in this all-pervasive stillness of mind. Now, we don't have to go be looking for, you know, near accidents, just like we don't have to go looking for people to be angry with us. But it's possible, that what I'm trying to point to is a possibility of having a tremendous unmoving mind, unmoving stillness, unmoving movement, still movement. Maybe it's like a river that's flowing and there's no ripples. It's a really clear, maybe shallow river, and it's really clear and no ripples and no bubbles or anything in the river. And you look in the river and you don't think it's moving because it's so clear. But if you put your finger in, you see that it's moving. I don't know if that's an analogy that works. Maybe what I'm talking about is kind of a little bit more like a mystical state, so it's very hard to kind of describe. But the unmoving moving, the stillness and movement which hold each other. One of the very powerful ways of cultivating stillness and unmoving, calm, and dealing with restlessness is to seriously consider who we are and what we need for our self-identity, what we need for our fundamental peace. To actually consider it, reflect on it. And in doing this, perhaps emptying of ourselves, maybe shedding, letting go of the kind of self-preoccupations which... self-concepts which are really extra and not needed. So this is one exercise that's interesting to do, kind of a thought exercise, is think about all the ways, ideas you have about yourself, what you will be in the future, and how people are going to see us based on what we think is going to happen in the future. So think about those and let go of those. Then think about all the ways in which you hold some idea of yourself based on what happened in the past. Oh, 10 years ago, I once yelled at someone, so, you know, I must have some problem with anger. You know, or yesterday, or maybe many times, you know, but I must be an angry person because of all the times in the past. But think about all the conclusions you made about yourself because of what happened in the past. They're based on memories. And let go of all the memories of who you were. Then think about all the ways in which you consider who you are that arise out of comparative thinking. You compare yourself to others who are better, do it right, and all that. And let go of all the comparative thoughts. And then think of all the ways in which other people see you. Other people judge you and see who you are and assume who you are. Those are other people's ideas. So let go of all those ideas. And then think of all the assumptions you have about who you are. Probably lots of you, you think there's all kinds of assumptions about who you must be. And let go of all the assumptions. And once you empty yourself and let go of all those different categories I described, who's left? You probably find yourself much more at peace going through that exercise. Because actually we need nothing. We need to be nobody for anybody in order to be at peace. It's possible to be completely at peace and not have anything to defend or anything to build or anything to create. The mind which is at peace doesn't require anything. To find that peace of heart that is unswayed by praise and blame, criticism, success and failure. To be a no one. Be a nobody. To find the great peace of not having to be anything for anybody, including for yourself. And finally, we cultivate stillness by not looking inward, not looking outward for a solution. Stop all your efforts of looking for something as a solution. Just be with how you actually are. So the Buddha said, this is a very famous passage, very important passage. He said, "One who clings is agitated." So he defines, you know, one of the primary causes for restlessness and agitation is we cling to things. One who clings not is not agitated. One who clings not has no agitation. There being no agitation, one is calm. There being calm, no craving exists. Where no craving exists, there is no coming or going. Where no coming or going exists, there is no arising nor passing away. Where neither rising nor passing away is, there is neither this world nor the world beyond, nor a state between. This, just this, is the very end of suffering. So if there's no craving, no clinging, the mind does not move. But as soon as there's clinging, the mind is in movement. But if the mind doesn't move, if you discover that unmoving mind that holds all the movement, that holds all the that unmoving mind, that unmoving stillness, that itself is the same thing as being freed of all your suffering. Because in that unmoving, there's no clinging. So may your minds and your hearts discover that wonderful unmoving place where it's not reaching for anything to cling to or anything to resist. And may you delve deep into your restlessness and come through to the other side, to that which is unmoving. So thank you for listening so patiently. Thank you for the wonderful day. And we could probably use a few people to help us maybe sweep the floor here and clean the bathrooms. Anybody who a few people can volunteer with that?